Welcome to Channel 9 of the STRY Radio Network, where stories live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ninth Story Podcast.
This is Season 6, Episode 7.
We are a podcast about writing.
We answer the burning questions you want to know.
I'm Immortal Alexander.
And I'm Jeanette Andromeda.
Today, our guest is the author of Ella Enchanted, among many other titles.
She also wrote the book Writing Magic, Creating Stories That Fly.
Welcome, Gail Carson Levine, to the Ninth Story Podcast.
It's great to be with you.
So what we're talking about today is creating magic with words. And Gail, one of your books just so happens to be called Writing Magic, which works out pretty well.
Jeanette has always been a huge fan of yours growing up, reading a lot of your
absolutely.
Books.
Absolutely.
And thank you.
Ella Enchanted was one of the books that I read growing up. I'm just like, I want to write stories like this. So thank you for writing that story. My sister and I geeked out about that and the Two Princes of Boromir. I'm going to mispronounce the name because in my head it was always something else. But we really have enjoyed your book, so I'm just going to try not to fangirl too hard.
Let yourself go.
Thank you for permission, because she's going to totally, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
Which is totally fine. But, you know, Jeanette and I have been doing this podcast for a while, and we're both kind of fledgling writers, and really cool that I got to have one of my stories featured on the Wicked Library podcast, the Christmas special, and then I had a poem on their Halloween special. And we've been reading your book, Writing Magic, which you had never read before, and it's been really inspirational. We've just been reading that book leading up to this interview because we really wanted to get more inside of the creative process than how you've been doing that and teaching that. And it's been really, really fascinating and inspiring for us.
Great.
So I can't wait to talk to you more about it.
Sure. And congratulations on the publications.
Thank you. So the concept of magic can be about creating childlike wonder or surprise for the audience. How do you approach magic in a story to create surprise or wonder?
I do think about that sometimes. And sometimes it's by contrast. So in my two mystery books, A Tale of Two Castles and Stolen Magic, the detective is a dragon, Minor. Mm-hmm. And it is very ugly, except for its beautiful, translucent, stained glass windowsy wings. So it's kind of the contrast between the two that I think provide the wonder. There are, you know, I'm kind of drawn to this because I loved the wonder in fairy tales growing up. So things like tables that set themselves with fabulous food and seven-league boots. Mm-hmm. I love to go into those things because in a fairy tale, which is told very quickly, they just show up and are not explored. Mm-hmm. So I think there's surprise and wonder in exploring them.
Sure.
In what it feels like to travel in seven-league boots and what it feels like to have to be invisible or in Two Princesses of Boromir, semi-invisible. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm thinking about.
It's kind of like the opposite in horror, where with the less you know about the creature or whatever it is that's hunting other folks in the story, the less you know, the more terrifying these unknown things become. Whereas in magic, the more descriptive you get, the more the reader gets pulled into the story and attached to those concepts.
Well, that's an interesting distinction. And I guess I have a question.
Sure.
So in horror, when the reader doesn't know much, do you know much? Do you know exactly what's going on?
Yeah, I think the reader ends up knowing a lot more than the characters in the scene.
Ah, okay.
But I'm talking about as far as like the the less you know about the main creature, the more unknown things are. Like you don't know what's around the corner. You don't know what might pop up. The unknown elements end up creating tension.
Sure.
And I think as the writer of that kind of a creature, yeah, I have a good idea of what's in the shadows. Personally, I like pretty well flesh those guys out in my head, but I'll only talk about the tentacle tongues leaking out through whatever, you know, because
right.
You only need a snippet, even though maybe the rest of it looks like a fluffy rabbit to me, but maybe that makes it more terrifying. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's wonderful to have a fluffy rabbit with, you know, that delivers a poisonous something.
Yeah.
That'd be terrifying. Oh, what a cute,
Right. I mean, it's like imagining if your dog suddenly didn't love you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more horrifying than that.
Absolutely, because you get so used to that relationship between like a dog and yourself. I think that's why Cujo's genuinely terrifying to me. So when you're imbuing a magical trait into a character, do you decide on the ability or the personality of the character first?
I don't really do either one. Mm-hmm. I'm usually directed in my choices. I start with an idea. And it's that idea that helps me figure out who my main character is going to be. And it, you know, it's kind of organic, so it's even hard to know. But I did, for example, one of my princess tales is based on the princess and the pea. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody in the world could feel a pea under 20 mattresses. But all that she's needed to do is have a rotten night's sleep. So, and that's the end point that I knew I was heading toward. So when I thought about who she could be, she had to be somebody who would have that rotten night's sleep. I could have made her an insomniac, but I didn't do that. There are choices, but they're limited. So I decided that she would be sensitive to everything and highly allergic. So if there was a single pigeon feather in the swan's down pillows, that would be enough to make her not sleep. And then I knew that she needed also to be likable. Mm-hmm. So even though she's in many, many ways incapacitated, she's also super sweet. And when push comes to shove at the end of the story, she comes through. And it's the sweetness that kind of reveals the hollowness at the core of that fairy tale, which is that's an insane test for a true princess, yeah, feeling a pea. And how can she be other than that? How can she be somebody that you would want to become a queen someday? So it was needing to put together those elements that got me to the character. In Ella Enchanted, who would resist a curse of obedience? What would that person be like? Mm-hmm. So it comes for me because the idea behind the story is the thing that guides me. So character rises out of that.
I like it. And I personally know that you work a lot in that fairy tale kind of world. But in case someone who's listening is not as familiar with your work, do you build a lot of your stories off of fairy tales?
I do, and part of it is because I'm not great at plotting. So if I have a fairy tale, it gives me kind of a very rough structure to work from. Not all my book, David Knight, is a historical novel. Mm-hmm. Two Princesses of Bamar was an attempt initially at the 12 Dancing Princesses that I couldn't do and that became an original fairy tale. And A Tale of Two Castles has the loosest of connection to Puss in Boots, but it's barely there. Mm-hmm. So the framework sometimes vanishes, but I'm helped if I have something that I can lean on.
Gail, what is your process for painting a scene?
Well, it's kind of remembering that people have to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I also am aware that they need to, you know, I try to remember, I don't try to, I do remember to bring in sensory data. And if I can find a smell that accompanies it, that's even better. You know, but also I do rely on people's ideas of castles and moats and, you know, I don't make the sky a livid green because if you change every element of the world, it's exhausting for the reader. So I rely on shared ideas of a castle, a moat, a joust, a knight. So what the reader sees, I hope, is pretty cinematic, but it's a lot of it is supplied by his or her imagination.
So do you find yourself writing for a specific time period in order to make the story feel more magical? This kind of ties into what you just said.
Yes. Let me go back to Ella, which was like kind of fairy tale, and I was not particularly thinking of a time period. And then I started getting letters from kids thanking me for teaching them so much about the Middle Ages. And I was horrified.
Oh, no.
So I started learning about the Middle Ages. So that's become more and more present in books that have followed. So when I wrote A Tale of Two Castles, mm-hmm. I used Macaulay's book Castle, which is a fabulous nonfiction reconstruction of a castle. Very easy to follow. And my castle is his castle. I do have fashion books through the centuries that I consult. In Ogre Enchanted, and in other books as well, Ogre Enchanted will be out next year, and it's a prequel to Ella Enchanted. And she's a healer, and when she becomes an ogre, she's still a healer. Mm-hmm. And I looked at a lot about medieval medicine, some of which made sense. You know, they did cataract surgery. Whoa. Astonishingly early. But in some ways, it was also horrifying.
Yeah.
And so I used that. In Ogre Enchanted, because Ella, I decided, had a sort of 18th century sensibility, mm-hmm. I went more to the 18th century. In my book, Ever, which is a Mesopotamian fantasy, I read a lot about ancient Mesopotamia. But one of the nice things about writing fantasy is, you know, you can abandon it at will as well. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of an underpinning, but you can veer away from it and not worry too much about getting it wrong, which is nice.
What are some magic-based tropes that you steer away from and why?
Well, there's only one that I think that annoys me, and that's where I can't visualize it. Mm-hmm. All my fantasy is very solid reality-based. So if you can't touch it, see it, hear it, then I'm annoyed. I'm annoyed at invisible force fields meeting mush, because I don't know what that is, and I don't know what's happening to a character in the midst of that. That's my objection.
That makes sense. I think that's why your stories stay so grounded.
Thank you.
What made you interested in magic in the first place?
I was addicted to fairy tales as a kid. I had the blue fairy tale book, the olive, the lilac, the brown. We also had the a kid's encyclopedia that doesn't exist anymore that had fairy tales in every volume with beautiful glossy paper illustrations. And I would go to those and read them and read them. And uncritically, it didn't trouble me that the ending of Snow White, where the evil queen dances in the red hot slippers, I was completely down with that. And, you know, many fairy tales, Hansel and Gretel is completely horrifying.
Yes.
And I was not horrified. I just read them happily and reread them and reread them. And so I know I also loved mythology. So I read and reread Edith Hamilton's mythology, Timeless Tales of Gods and Heroes. Mm-hmm. And all of that, as soon as I started writing, I went back to. And, you know, I'm a very practical person, but in my imagination, anything can happen.
Gail, how do you keep the story moving along?
I get very sleepy if it's not. And I start to feel like I'm slogging through quicksand. And when that happens, I have to stop and I have to figure out where I went wrong. And sometimes I have to go back to an earlier point in my story. And often the problem is that I've been reluctant to get my main character into enough trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I love her and I don't want the worst to happen to her, but sometimes I have to make the worst happen and then things get moving again. But I get lost in stories. And in most of my books, by the time it's published, I've tossed hundreds of pages in almost every book. And I just think it's the cost of doing business. And that's the way it is when I'm pretty much of a pantser. I do, lately I've been outlining a little bit, but I struggle to find my way through a story, and in the process, I accept that I have to throw out a lot. And then I do celebrate that I have enough of an imagination and enough stick-to-itiveness to know that even though I throw out all those pages, I can keep creating and come up with hundreds more.
It's just kind of the off cast as you go. It's the pencil erasers as marks as you go. That's all.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of the wonderful things about. I don't know if I'd be a writer if there were no computers, because
mm-hmm.
it's so easy to delete. And you know, I have a system. If I toss something, I don't send it into the void. I save it in a separate file.
Mm-hmm.
For each book, I have a file called Extras, because I always think, well, I may need that, and sometimes I do. So I don't lose anything.
That's awesome.
And when I've changed something significantly, I save it as a new version. So if it's not working, I can go back to the old version, and it's intact.
I think that's one of the things that you talk about in your book, Writing Magic, that I need to start doing, because I will just delete things and then go, oh wait, what did I write, you know?
Yeah, no,
a few weeks later. No, copy paste elsewhere.
Do you know my book Writer to Writer?
That one's next on my reading list, because I haven't read that one yet.
I go into that even more in mm-hmm. Writer to Writer, which is based on my blog.
Your blog I have read.
Great.
So there's some things that you talk about in your blog that I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. But one thing that you kind of touched on in just now and in your book, Writing Magic, you mentioned making your characters suffer. And I know that got your book banned in at least one place, but why do you think that is important?
Well, because there's really no story without a character's. There's almost no story. There are Lori Colwin, who wrote for adults, who's died, but she managed to write books that were gripping and nobody ever suffered. Hmm. But I haven't figured out how to do that. And that's what keeps somebody turning pages, is to be put, you want to make the reader suffer so the reader will keep reading, to be put out of her misery.
It worked.
So that's essential. You know, and the crazy people who banned the book, I would challenge them to find other than Laurie Colwyn, a novel in which nobody suffers.
Yeah, you look at
it's
something
not
like,
an interesting book.
Yeah, you look at something even like Snow White. I mean, she technically dies and then and then comes back. So there's suffering. There's a witch falling off a cliff. There's all sorts of things happening in that.
Yeah.
And that's Disney. So I think that was it like a Christian school or was it like really, really strict as far as their rules? Or what was the reasoning behind the banning other than the concept of suffering for the character?
No, it was a school district. And it was in Illinois. If you're listening, I don't think that the people who banned it ever read the book.
Probably not. Probably not. They probably just heard that one thing and bop, 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 bop. We don't want suffering at all.
Yeah.
No, I can remember reading your books way late into the night going, oh my God, what's going to happen next? I have to find out. And then it's like 3 a.m. and I'm like, I'll just read this at school tomorrow. I was one of those kids.
I apologize to your teachers.
It's okay. You kept me more focused, I think. It meant I had to get my homework done fast so I could get back to reading.
Ah!
Part of the magic in your worlds is the personality of your characters. How do you build these amazing, quirky characters that are so full of personality?
Well, again, it has a lot to do with the idea behind the story. And in my latest, The Lost Kingdom of Bamar, is kind of based on Rapunzel. And Rapunzel is abducted at the beginning of the story. And so I was thinking about my child is very young and doesn't remember her birth parents, but what is it like to be snatched out by people who are willing to take a child? Mm-hmm. And this is a very Spartan, militaristic society, and what is it like to grow up in there and to never feel entirely loved, and what does that do to the child? And she kind of becomes what they want her to be, which is self-denying and determined, but also with flaws that go with that a little bit. She's socially awkward. So it's kind of thinking about what's going to move her through the story. And at the same time, I'm building in elements that are immediately going to create some of her suffering. There is another element that I've written about a little bit. There's a little romance in most of my books. Not all, but most. And a lot of that comes from my parents, who were in love their whole marriage. And I saw that part of it was that they complemented each other. So my father never finished high school and was diffident and didn't take credit. But my father was very, very sweet. And my mother, who also didn't take a lot of credit, but my mother finished college and went on to a graduate degree, and my father loved having a brilliant wife, and my mother loved having a sweet husband, and my mother was not always sweet. She was more acerbic. Mm-hmm. So it was that complementing each other. So when I'm framing a match, I'm often looking for that way that they can mesh. And so I'm giving one quality to one and a quality that will meet up to another. And sometimes that can be very deep, but sometimes it can be very light. So in one of my princess tales, in the one that's based on Sleeping Beauty, I make her, because in the fairy tale itself, the crazy part of it that got me writing is that when the prince who goes through the hedge to find her, when he gets there, he kisses her. But all he knows about her at that point is that she's pretty and she doesn't snore. So I was looking for a reason, a way to explain how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And even after 100 years, she has this reputation because she is, I forget, I think 10 times smarter than anybody on the planet.
Yeah.
And I give him this insatiable curiosity. And he's after her because he figures she can satisfy his curiosity, which she can, although her answers are generally insane, but so they work. And so that's also part of creating a character.
So you kind of, again, you touch on a lot of these things as we go, but there's one thing that you're particularly good at with your writing, and it's balancing the sense of drama with keeping a lighthearted tone. And how do you find that balance?
Well, I'm fairly lighthearted. You know, and I'm fairly lighthearted, but I'm aware of the deeper notes of life. So that's kind of baked in me. And, you know, that's part of what makes it possible. Writing is hard, as you might have noticed. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I love the best is writing a funny scene. So being able to write a funny scene is part of what gets me through the writing. Or even a funny second lifts my spirits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a lot of strategies to make it possible to keep writing. But one of them is being able to be funny.
When you think of a new book or a new story, where do you start? Is it a title, a place, a character?
It's generally, if I'm working from fairy tales, it's, as I said, with Sleeping Beauty. It's how do I explain this craziness? Mm-hmm. How do I explain this king and queen who think that their son has to marry somebody who can feel a pee? I've been thinking, this wouldn't work for a child audience, but I've been thinking a lot about Aladdin. Mm-hmm. And maybe it could, maybe someday it will, but he's, if you remember the fairy tale, he gets this old lamp, which you rub and a genie appears. And he marries the sultan's daughter. And the old lamp is in the castle. And he goes off hunting wherever he goes. He never tells his wife that this is more than an old lamp. If she knew that important piece of information, she wouldn't give it away, mm-hmm. which is what she does, which creates a great deal of the drama in the story. So why doesn't he tell her? Well, he falls in love with her without seeing her. She's being carried in a palanquin, and he knows she's the sultan's daughter. And that's all he knows. And maybe the tip of her veil is trailing out, or a dainty ankle. But that's all he knows. Mm-hmm. And they marry. He has no reason to trust her. And a lot of the trouble, you know, he may think, she also has no reason to love me. Mm-hmm. I don't want her to have this genie to control, because if she rubs it, she gets the genie. So it's that kind of conundrum which is at the heart of so many fairy tales, and at the heart of anything that I write is like some question that I'm unpacking. You know, my historical novel called Dave at Night is very loosely based on my father's childhood. And my father was an orphan who was sent to an orphanage to live. And he had a miserable childhood. He never talked about it. But my father was the most joyous person I've ever known. And after he died, I didn't start writing until he died, until after he died. And I missed him very much. And I wanted to explain his joy. And so I wrote the historical novel to answer that question for myself, to answer how this child, who is given up for adoption by his stepmother, who is not taken in by any of his relatives, although his older brother and older sister are, but a different older brother goes to the orphanage with him, and a younger half-brother does. But these are children, and the tragedy of all the children in this orphanage is that they are unwanted. Mm-hmm. How does this person get out of it? This delightful, joyful man. So in all my books, there is a question. That's how I do it.
I think it's beautiful. And to explore that question for yourself, it's got to be really healing too. Like, I can imagine it would be to just kind of revisit these thoughts and be able to really work on them together in a way.
Yeah, well, it certainly drew him closer to me after, mm-hmm. you know, I couldn't talk to him anymore.
So it sounds like your dad, in both real life and in the book where he's one of your characters, he sounds like a great hero because of his joy. When you write heroes or heroines, what do you think makes them great?
Well, because they persevere through everything that I pile on them. You know, and that's, I admire that in people. Mm-hmm. I admire that in myself. You know, writers are, you know, I think it was Lauren Bacall who said that old age is not for sissies, which I'm discovering is true. But writing is not for sissies either. So people who write, I think, are heroes. And I put heroes in my book who keep going in spite of the odds.
What makes a great villain for you in your books?
Well, I guess my favorite villain, I think, I don't know. One of my favorite villains, anyway, is... and Valis in Two Princesses of Bamar, the dragon. Mm-hmm. Because she's a villain. She winds up killing every human she takes to her lair. But she also falls in love with them until she falls out of love with them, and that's unfortunate for them. But she's lonely, and the reader knows that, and she's entertaining, and she's funny. And I think it's that human wounded side of a villain that is, like in my Disney fairy books, the dragon Kaito, until the last book, but even there, is pure evil, and he's just kind of an object to work against. He's not as interesting as other villains. In Fairest, Ivy, she's not the only villain in there. There's Scully in the mirror. And in both cases, in the case of Ivy, you see how insecure she is and how shallow her values are. And that comes straight out of the fairy tale Snow White, where beauty is the only, well, Snow White herself, even though she's in the original fairy tale, totally passive, mm-hmm. is passive and sort of good in a bland way. The queen is judging her worth solely on her beauty. And that's a terrible curse. Mm-hmm. And Ivy in Fairest is cursed that way. And she's vulnerable. And I think that the reader has sympathy for her, and I have sympathy for her. And even Scully in the mirror, who is despicable, but his part of his despicableness is that he's confined in a mirror by Lucinda. And, you know, who knows if he would be, if he had complete free will, if he would continue to be so despicable. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of pitiable side of villains that I think round them out and make them tragic and interesting.
Yeah, I think it is always the imperfections that make any character feel more human and more relatable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Gail, for some people, it's childhood memories. For some people, it's daydreaming. Where does the magic of story come from within you?
I don't know.
I love that answer.
I was a total reader as a kid. And I think that, you know, if you read and reread and reread and read, a kind of story shape gets, you absorb that. So maybe that's it. That's the best I can do, because I don't know.
Everything becomes a story, I think, for us, for writers. It's everything you see, everything you smell, everything you read. It sticks with you and just kind of keeps brewing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm certainly not in unique in that.
Yeah. I just like to ask it sometimes.
Yeah.
So obviously fantasy and fairy tales in particular have really inspired you. Are there any other genres that you find yourself drawn to that inspire you?
Well, the inspiration is indirect, but I love poetry. And there are poems in most of my books. And last year, I graduated from NYU's MFA program in poetry. So I read poems, I write poems for adults and for kids in my books. I don't know exactly what, well, poetry certainly makes me very aware of language.
Mm-hmm.
And since studying poetry and writing it a lot, I'm even aware when two syllables are very alike in a sentence. And depending on what I think works better is I'll even change to a synonym to get away from that sound echo.
Mm-hmm.
Or I may use a synonym to get the echo. So poetry does that. But also poems are subtle. And I think that helps in trusting the reader. Because somebody who writes poetry expects a lot from a reader. But I also expect a lot from readers. I think it's annoying if the writer, you know, doesn't trust the reader. So I think poetry helps with that too. And also poetry is very often about very fundamental things. And also poetry in poems, people are not always, poets are not always their best selves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it opens the door to writing about stuff that isn't admirable and finding a place for that. So poetry, yay poetry.
Who are some of your biggest influences?
Jane Austen and her wit, I adore. I would like to say live inside me. I aspire to that kind of wit. But books that I loved. And to go back to your question about lightness.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, I adored Anne of Green Gables, all the Anne stories. And they were, among other things, very funny. When I started, I wrote Ella because I had just read Beauty by Robin McKinley. And I do want, even though this isn't reading, but I was very lucky that when I was getting started, a teacher named Margaret or Bunny Gable, she no longer teaches there, but she was teaching at the New School. And she taught a course in writing for kids. It was a workshop format. Which I took, I left myself back for several years to retake it with this class full of amazing writers. And I still, so that when I talked about including sensory information,
mm-hmm.
that comes from that class where I would remember, oh yeah, don't forget smells, don't forget sounds, because sight is our most important, you know, humans operate more from sight than anything else. But I remember because of that class, to bring that in. When I start a book, I'm aware that I'm often including information that just because I need to know it and the reader doesn't. So I may put it in anyway and know that I'm going to take it out. Mm-hmm. But that was something I heard in that class all the time. Not critically, just kind of, this is interesting. It probably is what you need to know, not what the reader does. So I was really lucky to have that. And when Ella won the Newbery Honor, Patricia Riley Giff won for Lily's Crossing, and she was also a Bunny student.
Wow. So since you obviously get a lot from that educational setting, I know you also were teaching for a while, and you still teach both, like, through your blog at the very least. Does teaching the craft of writing inspire you as well?
Yes. I love the blog. I love doing it. For one thing, I love reading the questions that pop up on the blog. Mm-hmm. And I love the discussion. And if you've read it at all, you see what a supportive environment it is.
Oh, yeah.
I had to shut it down only once. Mm-hmm. It was only one time when somebody flamed.
Oh, no.
And I publicly said, this is not what we do here. And that person apologized and came back supportively. And people come up with the most wonderful ideas. But it's also great for me because when I revisit a topic, I remind myself of things that I need to remember. Mm-hmm. So it's great for that as well. And also, because several times my publisher at HarperCollins has not liked my titles, and I've crowdsourced titles to the blog and gotten titles for several books from the blog, which has been heavenly.
Yeah.
And I do a free workshop for kids in the summer in Brewster, New York, where I live, through the library, for kids 10 through high school, through mm-hmm. senior in high school. And for 6 weeks every summer, if anybody's listening, call the library. It's not an online course. It's there. So they have to get to Brewster mm-hmm. weekly for 6 weeks. But one high school senior came from Illinois one summer.
Wow.
And I love doing that too, because I give the kids homework mm-hmm. and it's, you know, I don't grade them, but I give them edits, and these are kids who love to write, and they do the homework even though they don't have to. Mm-hmm. And it's fun for me to see what they come up with and their eagerness. And I've discovered a few young writers who have knocked my socks off. So it's a wonderful thing.
That's amazing.
It really is. Yeah. It's like, it's so cool to have to give that opportunity to young writers alone. It makes me feel good. I'm not even part of it. It's just like, yes, keep doing it. It's so important, because people don't... It's amazing to see a kid when they find the space that they feel safe enough to just try. You know, so often it's like, oh, you're trying, that's not cool. But when you're in a space like that where it's, you don't even have to do your homework, but you have to do your homework because you need to, you want to, like, to at a deep level, that's just... really cool to hear that you're helping get people excited that way. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love it.
Normal everyday things can create wonder in our stories. And I love how your book, Writing Magic, asks the reader to use their senses, use how they take in the world to describe a scene. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I did, when I was in the MFA program, I I think I'm answering your question. Tell me if I'm not.
Okay.
But I taught a creative writing class for undergrads. And one time I said, well, okay, you can take the tiniest thing. Like, for example, and we were sitting around a big table, and they said, well, suppose suddenly the table grew feet. And the table starts moving around. And supposing I went to the blackboard and I started writing on it, but the words were symbols. And I expected you, I talked about the symbols as if they were English. And then supposing the light fixture came down and started moving. So how does your character react? What does your character do? Does your character admit that anything is wrong? Or, you know, so we can take any moment in, you know, supposing I start, I'm looking at, talking to you, I'm looking at my laptop. Supposing I start typing on it and I press T-H-E, but what appears on the screen is something entirely different. The smallest tinkering with reality can plunge us into horror, into fantasy, into anywhere. And that it's fun to think about that. Was that the question?
I think that answers.
It's a great answer.
Great.
Okay.
But I definitely wanted to, I really just enjoyed a lot of the exercises in the book about...
Yeah, your writing prompts are pretty fantastic.
Yeah, prompts to get kids to notice things and to write for an entire day what you're noticing about your breathing, the sounds when you're walking up and down stairs, and all these little details, and then how if you write the little details in, then your reader can experience it.
I love writing the prompts.
It shows. It really shows. And it, like, in your prompts, it shows the care. It shows just kind of pushing that inspiration. And I mean, I had to read this a little bit quicker than I would have liked. I wish I had discovered this book a little bit sooner, but I'm like bookmarking every page with a prompt. I'm like, I'm coming back to this because I want to play with that. And it's just the fun in it and the way you kind of shift how whoever's reading this book, you're going to look at the world totally differently. It's not just you're walking outside and you're going to your car. You're walking outside and it's a gorgeous day and there's leaves falling down around you or something. Like, it smells weird, though. Why does it smell weird? And then off you go on another story, you know?
Yeah.
I love it.
Thank you.
So what curiosities, history, whatever, what makes you curious that you find in real or fantasy that really inspire you?
Well, right now I'm working on a, I'm just about 60 odd pages in on a historical novel about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, and which is my father's ancestors. I'm amazed and fascinated by, and horrified by many of the things that I'm discovering there. And this will be a middle grade book, so I'm comforting myself that there are many middle grade books about the Holocaust, because some the things that happened were just awful. But I'm interested, I've read a biography of Queen Isabella and Ferdinand, and now I'm reading A Daily Life of Jews in Spain. And like an example that I've learned that I find totally fascinating is that throughout the medieval period, the kings of Spain were, you know, people complain about taxes today, but the things that you were taxed on or fined for, had to pay a penalty for, the kings were always looking for a way to take money out of the pockets of their subjects. And so, for example, they learned Jewish law so that they would get involved if somebody violated a Jewish law.
Whoa.
The person would have to pay a penalty to the king. So I'm learning, and I'm figuring out how to weave this stuff in. And it's blowing my mind. And also, it's making me feel exceedingly lucky that this is what I do, that I can explore something like this and find a way to present it to children.
Yeah.
And I'm figuring, in a time, medieval Spain was a little better than the rest of medieval Europe in this regard, in that women had more education, Jewish women had more education and a little bit more agency than they did in other places. But I'm working hard to find a way to give my main character agency at a time when women would not have it and girls would not have it. So that's one of the challenges that's forming her character, is that I've given her this very big, she's kind of a mathematical savant, and her family, that's something that's much needed and much valued. So that's how I'm creating her character. But that's kind of where I take off from. And that's what I'm thinking about right now.
I love that. How, since you are a pantser for most of your novels, how much research really goes into each of these?
Well, this book, the research is daunting.
Okay.
I'm thinking about ways to maybe, because I don't want to get a doctorate in medieval Spain. So I'm trying to think of some kind of disclaimer that I can put in that will let me not have to hew so closely to the facts that doesn't look lazy. So I don't know. If you have any ideas of how to express that, I'm interested.
Maybe you could find someone with a doctorate, and then when you finish it, send it off, and then he can fix your facts.
I do have made a contact like that, but anyway, that's,
I don't know.
That is what I'm thinking about.
It could be something like, I've researched this to the best of my ability, but if you want to know the truth, you need to go look, or something like that. I don't know.
Maybe. Or if you find a resemblance to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, well, that was intended.
That works. That's funnier. I love it.
We are so glad that we decided to do this interview now, because we're,
yes,
Jeanette and I are actually going to be going into the NaNoWriMo well, it's like a not competition,
yeah,
but it's like a more of a
I know that.
Well, she writes about it on
the
blog.
To go into NaNoWriMo, and this is Jeanette's second time. This is my first time doing NaNoWriMo. And so since we've discovered your books on writing, and they've been extraordinarily helpful.
Yes, they have.
We're just excited that we happen to do this now, just kind of serendipity, because we're going into this really daunting task, and now we have tools to help us along the ride.
Oh, well, my hat is off to you for doing it.
Thanks. I tried it once before. I only got to 6,000 words and then got stuck in the editing loop. So I'm not going to allow myself to edit this time and barrel through. But I'm so intimidated / excited to jump into it and just be like, all right, let's see how much further I can get this year.
What's the goal? How many words?
50,000.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I think it's about 1,800 words if you want to hit the goal. And so usually people will give themselves like a 2,000 word goal, so
that way
they can kind of mush it back and forth day to day and keep around 1,800.
Wow.
It's
so.
A lot. It's a lot.
Yeah.
I'm already sort of outlining a story where I'm going to allow myself a little bit of Arabian Nights to filter in, where there's a main story, but then there's one character who's a storyteller. So if I ever get stuck, it's just story time, and off on a tangent she'll go.
That's great. That's a great idea.
I think it'll help me because I definitely have a hard time finishing my project. So this one, I just want to like get as much meat as I can out of it.
Yeah.
And for me, it's actually giving a title to each chapter to me helps me think about what's going to happen in that chapter and kind of envision it. For whatever reason, when I do short story writing, titles are extraordinarily helpful to me to kind of find that space in my head and then expand out from there.
That, you know, everybody works differently. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like a terrific way to keep yourself, to keep moving.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, I feel that chapter's done, and what's next? It is tea time. Go.
Yeah.
That was just the first word that popped into my head. But yeah, I just wanted to thank you for, I don't know, just the things that you write, all of the things that you've written. Your books definitely affected myself and my sister as we were growing up, and the fact that you had these just amazing characters has really motivated us as human beings, I think.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you. I don't know, it's really amazing talking to you and to be able to pick your brain for a little bit. It's just great to hear a little bit more in depth about your process, and it makes it so much more attainable to feel like it's okay, you can jump in, you can make mistakes, you're going to throw away things, it's fine.
Oh yeah. I would revise every book that I've written that's published, mm-hmm. if I could. Mm-hmm. But the end point is when it appears in print, then you're done.
Yep. It's kind of like, I'm also an artist. It's the same thing. It's like, as soon as I put that painting in someone else's hands, it's done. You're done. Yeah. You're not going to take it off of someone's wall and keep working on it. It's like, no, it's not done. Right. What? I love it. Stop.
Jeanette's been doing like Inktober this month, and so she's doing an illustration a day. And so typically she would probably go back and retouch some of these mm-hmm. and add things. And because it's an illustration a day,
I'm forcing myself not to. At the moment.
She hasn't touched any of it. It's just up there, and it's really fantastic because just this exercise alone of doing Inktober has helped her kind of define her own style and stick to a specific style.
Which is why I'm looking forward to NaNoWriMo, because if just Inktober can really help me artistically, I know NaNoWriMo, going in with a few more resources this time, will help me stay on track and then add to what I'd love to get out of it is just getting into that habit of writing every day again. Used to do that.
Ah, yeah.
So
yeah, well, that's always good.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's something we're both trying to force ourselves to do. And when I used to do blog posts and short stories on the blog that Jeanette does, that was something that helped me get that that pattern going, that habit. And now NaNoWriMo, I think, is going to help both of us kind of push through and push ourselves beyond our limits mm-hmm. and create some really great habits.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing everything that you've learned with us. Where can people find more about you, Gail, if they wanted to learn more about your writing or even read your books?
They can go to my website, GailCarsonLevine.com, and there they can click on my books, on my blog, on, you know, if I'm going to appear somewhere, they'll mm-hmm. find it on my website. And they can also follow me on Instagram, which is just Gail Carson Levine, Facebook.
So everyone listening, I highly recommend reading Gail's books, Writing Magic and Writer to Writer, though I haven't read that one yet. I plan to, because it is a lot of what you already have on your blog. So if you want to go read the blog, that's also a great place to get resources and inspiration and a hurrah from a group of other writers. It's a great place to go. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about while you're on with us? Something you want to promote?
Well, I'll mention, I don't know how many of your listeners belong to SCBWI. But at the national conference, I will be teaching a 2.5-hour workshop in writing fantasy.
Beautiful.
That's February 3rd in New York. But you need to sign up for the conference.
Thank you so much for your time,
yeah,
Gail.
Thanks.
Seriously, thank
great.
You.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you so very much, Gail Carson Levine, for taking the time to speak with us about writing.
As we mentioned in this episode, Alexander and I are prepping for NaNoWriMo.
We will be going into more detail about our NaNoWriMo preparation on our November 6th episode.
So if you are also taking part in NaNoWriMo, that's National Novel Writing Month in November, please let us know on Twitter and or Facebook.
For full show notes, please visit podcast.ninthstory.com/S6E07.
Make sure to tune in next week as we will have on author Darren Shan, author of the Saga of Darren Shan book series, a.k.a. Cirque de Freak, among many other titles.
This has been the Ninth Story Podcast.
Keep creative, my friends. Good on us for getting some stuff
Hello.
Done.
Welcome to Skype Call Testing Service. After the beep, please record a message. Afterwards, your message will be played back to you.
I feel extraordinarily magical today.
As do I. Magic rainbow kitten magical levels
this
of magic.
This is a spell of purple. It happened. Magic. Explosion.
Feel extraordinarily magical today.
As do I. Magic rainbow kitten magical levels
this
of magic.
This is a spell of purple. It happened. Magic.
If you are able to hear your own voice, then you have configured Skype correctly. If you hear this message, but not your own voice, then something is wrong with your audio recording settings.
Or your mind.
Please check your microphone and microphone settings, or visit Skype.
Check the inside of your skull for,
thank you for using
any
Skype
damages in the fall.
Goodbye.
When you rolled off the bed this morning. Goodbye.
Goodbye.